Do I have to hold it down?
No.
No, I'm not. I'm just... Thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. First, I'd like to thank Susan for the loan of her okesa, her priest robe, this morning. Michael and I left the house without our bags, with our okesas in. And we didn't get much sleep last night because our old cat is probably in his last days or hours even. So I'm a little not 100% this morning. And it's the full moon. It's the full moon tonight. Don't know if we'll be able to see it. A little bit. Looked a little bit like the clouds were opening. We might not be able to see it. Again, we didn't see it last month. And we might not get to see the green comet. Has anyone seen the green comet? C2022E3, otherwise known as the Green Comet. If you Google Green Comet, you can see photos of it. It's quite beautiful. And it's the closest it's come to Earth in 50,000 years. But apparently, even if the sky was clear, it would be really hard to see because the full moon is so bright. Unless you have really good equipment and the knowledge to know where to find it. But when something, one of these celestial events occurs, I always like to just imagine what it was like for ancient peoples to look into the sky and see a comet, a green comet. Before our human-created lighting blocked out so much of the skies. So last month, I gave a talk about the moon in Zen literature and poetry. The moon as a symbol of the pure light of unobstructed awareness. How it's always there, right? Even in the daytime. And sometimes you see it in the blue sky. You see it in the morning, either just a little half moon or sometimes a full moon faint up in the sky. So it's always there, even behind the clouds. And when the clouds are just streaky across, moving across the moon, it somehow makes the moon even more beautiful. Or when there's a hazy halo around the moon. And the lesson here, of course, is to see our delusions, what clouds our clear mind for what they are, and to let them pass. And to see the moonlight reflected on the waves of the ocean or in a dewdrop on the grass, pervading all that is, ever flowing, ever transforming. And I started my talk about the moon last month with a poem by the beloved Canadian poet Patrick Lane, who died year before last, I think. And the poem from his posthumously published book of last poems called The Quiet Within Me. And later, after I did that talk, I looked back at the book and I realized that the opening poem in the book is another moon poem, another reverie of an aging poet facing the end of his life. So I'm going to start with that poem today, and it's called Living in a Phantom Hut. A wolf hair brush in a yellow jar, ice on a pool at dawn, a single koi rising, Basho on the road to the deep north. There is nothing you can see that is not a flower. There is nothing you can think that is not the moon. a tuft of hair hooked on a strand of barbed wire, a rusted fence above the Barriere River, whitewater, old volcanoes, a crow picking at caribou bones, content. Those mountains I wandered through when I was young, there was a need for a small fire in the night. Still, I wept back then for what could not be undone. Old misfortunes can bring a man peace. My face reveals my face, my hands, my hands. There is nowhere I can go where I haven't been. When I hold the brush to my ear, I hear the moon. So that reference in the second line, oh, first, a single koi rising, you know what? A koi is the Japanese carp, those big, ornamental, beautiful Japanese carp. And Patrick Lane had a beautiful, beautiful garden in his later years and with a pond with koi. So that's that reference. But the other reference in that second line, Basho on the Road to the Deep North, is of course to the great 17th century Japanese haiku poet, Basho, who was famed for his pilgrimages and his wanderings, especially the longest one into the remote parts of northern Japan. And he wrote an account of that prose mixed with haiku called Oku no Hosomichi, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. And after the rigors of that journey, his health was declining, and he spent several years visiting friends and students and spending periods of relative seclusion, the longest of which was a six-month period in 1690, 3 years before his death, in a hut on the mountainside overlooking Lake Biwa outside of Kyoto. I didn't check, but he only lived into his late 50s. I forget exactly. And our Japanese founder of our school of Zen, Dogen, only lived to be about 59 as well. You know, so some of us have already exceeded what was then considered old age. He wrote a prose piece about that time in that hut called Record of the Hut of the Phantom Dwelling. So that's where Patrick Lane took the title of his poem, from Basho's hut. Basho's hut was originally inhabited by a monk named Genju, which means phantom dwelling, hence the name of the hut. And the hut was a shabby, rundown little hut adjacent to a Shinto shrine, and the hut just had one little room and another little side room with an image of Amida Buddha, a little shrine. And this is how he describes, just a little passage. I'm like a bagworm that's lost its bag, a snail without its shell. I've tanned my face in the hot sun of Kisakata in O, and bruised my heels on the rough beaches of the northern sea where tall dunes make walking so hard. And now this year, here I am drifting by the waves of Lake Biwa. The grebe attaches its floating nest to a single strand of reed, counting on the reed to keep it from washing away in the current. With a similar thought, I mended the thatch on the eaves of the hut, patched up the gaps in the fence, and at the beginning of the fourth month, the first month of summer, moved in for what I thought would be no more than a brief stay. Now, though, I'm beginning to wonder if I'll ever want to leave. I hear the voice of the woodsman making his way to Mount Kasatori, and the songs of the seedling planters in the little rice paddies at the foot of the hill. Fireflies weave through the air in the dusk of evening. Clapper rails tap out their notes. There's no lack of beautiful scenes. Patrick Lane's mood in the poem is similar, reflective. He remembers Basho on his journeys and quotes the old master's words, "There is nothing that you can see that is not a flower. There is nothing that you can think that is not the moon." And then he looks into the pond in his own garden and he remembers his own wanderings, the Barriere River. There's an endnote. Does anybody know where the Barriere River is? No? There's an endnote that says it's in mid-northern BC. It's a tributary of the North Thompson River, which flows into the Fraser. And it's called Barriere because of fish traps that were placed across the river mouth by the Siquimec people. Perhaps they still do. I've seen the old photographs. "Those mountains I wandered through when I was young, there was need of a small fire in the night. Still, I wept back then for what could not be undone. Old misfortunes can bring a man peace. My face reveals my face, my hands, my hands." So he's reached the time in his life when he can see his old misfortunes as the clouds crossing the face of the moon. "There's nothing you can think that is not the moon. His face reveals his face, his hands, his hands." And no doubt his face is grooved with lines, and his hands are veined and scarred and marked by the rough and tumble life of his youth. Such deep acceptance. It reminds me of the poem I read last month in my moon talk from last month by Izumi Shikibu, who was the 11th century Japanese woman poet who was famous for her passionate love affairs and love poetry, but later in life she became a Buddhist nun and lived in seclusion. And she wrote, "Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight, too, leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house." So both the cold wind and the moonlight penetrate through the cracks of our existence in the impermanent dwelling of our lives. Those who study, have you ever studied dream symbols? If you look in dream symbol books, you'll find usually that the house dreams represent the self, and not just the physical self, not just the body, but memory, emotions, the unconscious, and what's sometimes called the higher self. So the basement, the attic, broken windows, a leaking roof all have symbolic meaning. So next time you have a house dream, see what it might be telling you. I've had lots. Basements, attics, crumbling floors. Our houses and ourselves are temporary constructions, aren't they? Our house and ourselves need care and maintenance, but inevitably fall into decay if we live long enough, if we do not encounter some earlier disaster. And we cannot hang on to them forever. Basho concludes his record of the hut of the phantom dwelling with these lines. "We all, in the end, live, do we not, in a phantom dwelling? But enough of that. I'm off to bed." That's how he ends it. And then he adds a haiku. "This temporary dwelling and a stone oak tree in the summer grove." I thought that it seems sort of a simple haiku, and yet his mind goes to the trees around the hut. If you've ever lived that simply in a small cabin, as Basho did, as Henry David Thoreau did, as Thomas Merton did, You may have experienced the trees and the birds outdoors as your companions. The indoors permeable to the outdoors. That might mean mosquitoes too, or a leaky roof. But the sound of the trees, the sound of the birds, that's your company when you live that way. Thoreau wrote this, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. So as I think you know, he went and lived in a cabin by Walden Pond. And wrote about it. But few people in our contemporary urban, digitally connected world ever deliberately live in such simplicity and solitude. Imagine a week without your phone and laptop, let alone a month or a year. I remember hearing on the CBC one day about a study of university-age young adults who became anxious after only an hour without their phones. Although we hear that increasing numbers of people live alone and suffer from loneliness, our culture does not equip us to appreciate solitude very well, to be fully at ease in our own skin, in our own company. But when we do take that chance, we may discover that we are in the company of the whole world. The great solitary writers knew this. Thoreau wrote that he was rarely lonely in his cabin on Walden Pond, except for once when he'd only been there a short time, and he was seized by a kind of an oppressive sense of aloneness. And he writes, in the midst of a gentle rain, while these thoughts prevailed, I was suddenly sensible of such sweet and beneficent society in nature, in the very pattering of the drops, in every sound and sight around my house, an infinite and unaccountable friendliness all at once, like an atmosphere sustaining me. Every little pine needle expanded and swelled with sympathy and befriended me. I was so distinctly made aware of the presence of something kindred to me, even in scenes which we are accustomed to call wild and dreary. And I thought that no place could ever be strange to me again. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk and writer who explored Eastern thought and Zen practice, yearned for, when he was living in the regimented monastic life of Gethsemane, the monastery in Kentucky where he spent many years, yearned to live in a hermitage for solitude. And finally he was permitted by the abbot to do so. There was a little house up on the hill above the monastery. And he found it more challenging and more deeply moving than he expected. This is the excerpts from his journals. And you see all these little markers from a previous talk a few years ago that I did about him. But just this little bit here where he says, in the hermitage, I see how quickly one can fall apart. I talk to myself. I dance around the hermitage. I sing. I feel within this individual self the nearness of disintegration. Yet I also realize that the exterior self can fall apart and be reintegrated too. This is like losing dry skin that peels off while the new skin forms underneath. Then he also says, one thing the hermitage is making me see, that the universe is my home, and I am nothing if not part of it. I recently read an essay by an American writer, Fenton Johnson, called Solitude and the Creative Life. And he it's an excerpt from a new book that he's written, which I will order. And he considers the role and practice of solitude in the lives of writers, poets, artists, and contemplatives. And he proposes a kind of secular monasticism, using the Latin term conversation morum, which means conversion of morals. It's the third vow that a monk takes upon entering, a Benedictine monk, upon entering the order. And I thought maybe it's something akin to the Bodhisattva vows that we commit to on this path of practice, to have our entire life, our thoughts, speech, and actions pervaded by our practice, pervaded by wisdom and compassion. And we will, because it's the full moon, very soon be chanting the Bodhisattva vows together that we do. This ancient practice of reciting the Bodhisattva vows, or the precepts, on the full moon. Johnson, the author, Fenton Johnson, has practiced with our founding teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher. I remember meeting him at Samish Island Sesshin years ago. And he cites Norman's everyday Zen approach to Zen practice for everyday life and ordinary people. So what would the principles of this secular monasticism, this everyday Zen monasticism, be? I asked myself, and I thought simplicity, quiet, gratitude, work practice, encompassing both solitude and community, both. Being able to move into solitude and into community. This past week, I searched and searched with great frustration for Norman Fisher's book of essays called Experience, Thinking, Writing, Language, and Religion. I just could not find that book, probably because I forgot that the title was Experience. And it's a white cover, and I just couldn't see it. And so as I just was writing this talk, for some reason I wandered into my room, and there it was. So I took it, and it's sort of divination thing I do sometimes, is I just open. And what I read, the sentence that my eyes fell upon, was this: monastic life is fundamentally a life of participation with everything and of kindness. Monastic renunciation is, in essence, letting go of the self-centered life. There it was. And then just above those lines, he says, in my own case, having spent a number of years living monastically at San Francisco Zen Center, where he was abbot for about 8 years, and many years before that, he says, I can bring the deep structure and feel of that life to my daily life in the ordinary world. This training has helped me a great deal to learn how to include others in what I do, and to feel that I am joined by others, even in my solitary acts. Now, Michael and I have not lived monastically as long as Norman did, by any means, but over the years, we've done many shorter and longer periods of monastic practice, and you do that even when you come to the Zendo for a couple of hours. You step into that simplicity. Or when we go for a week-long sesshin or intensive retreat. And we've also done a number of solo retreats in quiet places, and also what we call hiking sesshin or hiking retreats when we go up in the mountains and walk and walk and walk. And I, what Norman said just in that quote really resonated for me, that the deep structure and feeling of those times underlies and supports my life and practice in the everyday world, even when it feels like the phantom hut of my life is coming apart at the seams. because, you know, it feels like that sometimes. But there's that underlying structure that our practice, or scaffolding, sometimes I think of it as a very, like those, in Japan, we used to see, particularly in traditional, like when an old temple or shrine is being repaired, these bamboo scaffolding made of lashed bamboo instead of big metal scaffolding, bamboo scaffolding, which is really both super strong and flexible. And I think that's the scaffolding our practice gives us. Among the many Zen writings that reference living in a hermitage or hut, one of the most beloved is the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage by the 8th century Chinese Zen master Sherto. And many of you know it. Michael and I have both talked about it before. So I just want to review some of my favorite lines. It begins, "I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap." When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk, innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. Those last lines are the key. This is it, this life, this body, this shabby, leaky hut, right here and now, intimately connected to the whole universe. Do not separate from it. Do not turn away from it, from any part of it, those parts in the basement that you'd rather not see. The whole world right outside your door. Patrick Lane, the poet, was not a monastic. He led a full, sensuous life. He was pretty rowdy in his youth, and he knew much suffering. Struggled with alcoholism for years. Had two failed marriages, and then a beautiful, long companionship with the poet Lorna Crozier. And yet, he also knew something of solitude. He found it in the mountains and late in life in his garden by the pond, so that he could say, "Old misfortunes can bring a man peace. My face reveals my face, my hands, my hands. There is nowhere I can go where I haven't been. When I hold the brush to my ear, I hear the moon." So for those of you who aren't that old yet, you don't have to wait until the end of your life. You may or may not get that chance. You can choose to practice solitude within your life right now, right here, by making time to sit in stillness in the hut of your own room, to walk in the forest, to have tea and quiet conversation. Not texting on your phone, but in real life with a person, tea, a treat, and quiet conversation, like the old Zen hermits did. Those old Zen hermits weren't total hermits. They loved having a visitor to come and have tea. Simply meditating, cooking, eating, working, and sleeping, allowing the preoccupations and distractions of your life to drop away, and the 10,000 things to come forward to greet you. To see the moon in a dewdrop and to hear it in a wolf hair brush. So thank you everyone for your listening today.
The chant on page 3.